This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When we last spoke with my guest, Joe Opala, he was caught in the middle of a coup in Sierra Leone. It was in the end of May, and we'd called to talk about his work finding cultural connections between this West African country and Gullah culture, the culture of African Americans on the islands off the Carolina coast. Opala is an anthropologist who had traced the history of a song from its origins in Sierra Leone to an African American family that is still singing it. When we interviewed him, the State Department was urging all Americans to evacuate Sierra Leone, but Opala insisted that he was going to stay in the country where he had lived for over 20 years. If you heard that interview, you probably wondered, as we did, what happened to him. We finally got a hold of him a few days ago after learning that he's back in the States. When we spoke in May, he felt confident that he was in the safest place in Sierra Leone's capital, the Mammy Yoko Hotel, where he had his office. Hundreds of foreigners had taken refuge there, and the Nigerian military elite who opposed the coup were headquartered there, giving him a sense of protection. Yesterday, I asked Opala when he realized it was a false sense of protection.
Actually, it took quite some time. On Monday morning, June the 2nd at 6 a.m., I woke up in the hotel to the sound of Nigerian gunboats firing, and it was unmistakable. You could tell that it was from a big ship, and I was quite happy. I thought that signaled the beginning of a Nigerian invasion of Freetown that would free us of these hooligans that had taken over the city. And in fact, I told the guests in the hotel, who were really quite frightened, that they shouldn't be frightened, that the Nigerians were no doubt landing troops and that we wouldn't be a target because the rebels who had taken over the city would be too busy fighting back the Nigerians. And I think it wasn't until around noon that I realized that we were in trouble. By 8 o'clock in the morning, we were taking a lot of firing. There was a lot of small arms fire being directed at the hotel. We got quite a few people into the basement, others seated in the hallway on the second floor. But it wasn't until about 12 or 1 that we really started taking a lot of fire. Rockets were fired. I later learned mortars were fired at the hotel. Even a helicopter gunship was brought in to fire at us, and an anti-aircraft gun. And when we started taking this very, very heavy firing, and the hotel was shaking, plaster was coming down, windows were being smashed, that I began to realize that the attack really was directed at us. Later that was confirmed by some Red Cross people who were staying in the hotel with us, that the full force of the rebels was actually being directed at us in the hotel.
Why?
The Nigerians had made a very serious error. I think the day before, they had flown some of their jets low over the military headquarters in Freetown, and it really had scared the devil out of these rebels. And I think that they felt that, the next step now is to show them that we also have naval power. So they fired their guns from their ships at 6 in the morning. They fired them into the sea. But the army leaders and the rebel leaders who had taken over Sierra Leone saw this as an opportunity to win a propaganda victory against the Nigerians. They claimed that the Nigerians had fired into the town. And sure enough, they were able to show bodies on the television and destroyed houses. I don't know if they deliberately destroyed those houses and killed those people or if they were just simply killed in the crossfire. But they took an opportunity to say to their people that the Nigerians have attacked and we're going to protect you. And they turned their full force on the unprepared Nigerian troops who were around the hotel. There were about 200 of them, but they weren't prepared to fight a major action. And for 10 hours, the Nigerians surrounding the hotel had the full force of the army and rebels against them.
Well, you had your office in this hotel. There were a lot of foreigners who were staying in the hotel or taking refuge there. Do you think anybody on either side cared about your safety?
I really feel that the Nigerians did care about our safety. And obviously, we would not have been targets had the Nigerians not been there. But I really think that they were trying to protect us as best as they could and with the limited resources that they had. We had International Red Cross people inside the hotel. I think most of them were Swiss. And they tried repeatedly to get the rebels and the soldiers to back off and declare a truce long enough to let 700 civilians out of the hotel. And they wouldn't agree, or they would agree, and then they would break their promise, and the firing would go on. So the Nigerians certainly would have been very happy to allow us out of the hotel to escape and then go on with their fight. But it was the people who were attacking who weren't concerned about the civilians.
Meanwhile, how badly hit was the hotel?
It was devastated. Rockets went through the windows. At one point, the rebels went and got a civilian Russian helicopter pilot and ordered him to fly his helicopter and fire very large rockets into the hotel. And he had to do it. He had no choice. They virtually had a gun to his head. And he missed. He deliberately missed. Otherwise, I probably would be dead. We'd all have been dead. But they did fire their small rockets and their mortars and their anti-aircraft gun. They burned out a large part of the fifth floor, I believe. Later on, after we did escape from the hotel, they went into the hotel and looted every single room. They took out all the television sets and the beds and just everything, the food. I mean, everything, desks, fax machines, Xerox machines, everything.
When the hotel was on fire, at least one of the floors was, did you try to put it out?
That's right. I think it must have been, it all ran together. I mean, you can imagine 10 hours of this. We've got no food and no water for 10 hours, and the firing is continuous. But I think it must have been at about 2 in the afternoon or 3 in the afternoon that the upper floors began to burn. And I was later told that's when they brought in the anti-aircraft gun. And the mattresses were burning, and we had very thick black smoke coming down from the upper floors. And we were faced for a time with the prospect of either dying there of smoke inhalation or running and escaping outside into the firing. And that was the one moment where I thought, I should say one of two moments where I thought I might die. But we were able to put the fires out. There were some very brave young men in the hotel who helped. I did what I could as well. A number of us grabbed fire extinguishers from the lower floors and ran up the stairwell to the upper floors, but they were firing through the windows in the stairwells. And you had to take your life in your hands just to get the fire extinguisher up to the upper floors. But we did manage to put the fires out.
How did you finally get out of the hotel?
That was a rather difficult situation. At about 6 o'clock, remember the firing began, the firing on the hotel began at about 8 in the morning. And at about 6 o'clock in the evening, the International Red Cross people in the hotel finally managed to negotiate a truce. The rebels outside the hotel agreed to allow the civilians to go through the front door of the hotel and out onto the street, and they said they would allow us to walk into the city. But we were on the phone with the United States ambassador to Sierra Leone, who was in the neighboring country of Conakry, and to the British ambassador to Sierra Leone, who was still there in the city. And both of them warned us not to go out the front door. These people have a history of taking hostages. They advised us to go out the rear door of the hotel and onto the beach. The International Red Cross people were alarmed immediately. They said, that's not what we negotiated, and we will not go with you out the back door. And if you go out the back door, they may very well shoot at you. The American ambassador told us from Conakry that there would be American Marine helicopters overhead, and that if they fired at us, that the helicopters would do their best to protect us. We had then to present these options to the 700 civilians, go out the front door into the hands of the rebels, or go out the back door into the hands, hopefully, of the American Marines. But we really couldn't tell these people that they may very well shoot at you if you go out the back door. It would have created panic. I think, fortunately, most everybody decided to go out the front door. There were a lot of African civilians there, and they went out the front door, and ultimately they were not harmed. The expatriates, I think almost all of them, went out the rear door, and I went out the rear door. When I left, I thought they're probably going to shoot, and you just have to run and just keep running for your life. We went out the back door. The Nigerians had run out of ammunition and were in the process of surrendering. There was this deadly silence, and you kept walking and walking, expecting to be fired at from behind. We walked right out onto the beach. There was no firing. We were totally exposed on the beach. and there were no Marine helicopters.
Well, the ambassador didn't make good on his promise?
Later, when I reached Conakry, an American embassy official told me that they were there. They were 2 or 3 miles off, that with their very sophisticated equipment, they could see us, and that they were prepared to move in at top speed if we were fired upon, but they didn't want to be there to draw fire onto us. I hope that's true. I'd like to believe that Uncle Sam was there to protect me, but I couldn't see anything.
Boy, I'll tell you, what a decision to have to make, to go out the front door and get risked. And risk being taken hostage, or the back door and risk being shot at.
We got out onto the beach and walked to the neighboring hotel, and I was expecting, you know, after having been inside that pressure cooker for 10 hours, mm-hmm. I was expecting that the neighboring hotel had also been looted. And yet, when I got to the hotel, I walked in, the electricity was working, the staff was there, it seemed normal. I walked up to the bar, and I, a very hesitating voice, I said, "A cold beer?" And the chap pushed a cold beer right in my face. It was completely normal situation. They did not have Nigerians protecting them, and therefore they did not draw fire the way we did at the Mamioko.
That quote normality must have seemed really surreal at the moment, given what you'd just been through.
It was a very strange situation to go in there and just find that all of a sudden I was safe, or appeared to be. That hotel, by the way, started drawing the refugees from the town. There were scores of expatriates whose homes had been looted. And whose shops had been looted, and they came packed into that hotel that night. And there was no place for me to sleep in the hotel. I slept on the grounds of the hotel. And that night, the rebels were looting the Mamioko just 2 blocks away, and they came over to us dressed in women's dresses with wigs that they had looted from the hotel, lipstick painted on their lips, smoking marijuana, and they danced for us with their machine guns. I think they were trying to tell us that they are absolutely out of their minds, and I think we all believe them.
My guest is Joe Opala. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Joe Opala, an American anthropologist who lived in Sierra Leone for 20 years. He recently fled the country to escape the military coup. Joe, to Americans who aren't closely following the story in Sierra Leone, it sounds like, you know, another coup in another small African country where there's chaos that is hard to explain or understand. Would you give us a context for understanding the coup?
Yes. You know, Sierra Leone, sadly, had really been moving toward democracy. In 1996, thousands, tens of thousands of Sierra Leoneans poured into the streets to vote in a democratic government, the first democratic government in about 25 years. And in some cases, they had to battle soldiers in the streets just to defend their ballot boxes. And the international community was very impressed with the elections, and Sierra Leone was getting a lot of assistance. So we thought things were improving. But sadly, there was an army coup on May the 25th. The army struck again. But they did something worse than in previous coups. They brought into their so-called government the RUF, the Revolutionary United Front, a group of terrorists who have been plaguing people in the countryside since 1991. These are terrorists. These are people who go from village to village looting and maiming, raping, and killing rural people, farmers. So you have the worst now of all possible worlds. You've got this army that's out of control, and then bringing these terrorists into the capital city. And for the first few days that they were there, they looted the whole capital city, everything, all the shops, homes of all of the expatriates, the international agencies, the food stores. They burned government buildings. They burned the National Bank. They went right through the city like a plague of locusts. And these soldiers who took over are simply not able to control the situation now. So you have enlisted men and you have these RUF rebels who are continuing the looting right up to the present moment. So it's not really been a coup. It's just been a complete breakdown of law and order.
You know, when we spoke to you a few weeks ago at the beginning of the coup, you said that you had no plans to evacuate because you'd been through coups there before and you felt that you needed to stay, and you needed to stay to help preserve the infrastructure of the culture so that when things return to normality, you'd be there to remind people about the history of the culture. What made you decide to evacuate?
Well, I wouldn't say that I was staying for such a noble purpose. I mean, that has been my goal, to contribute whatever I could over the years to the cultural development of the country. But my experience has been in the past in these situations that the expatriates, the foreigners living in the country, tend to panic. And that really the situation, if you know the country from the inside, the situation is generally not as drastic as your embassy tells you it is or as that other expatriates tell you it is. And I have to tell you that even after experiencing that 10-hour attack, I was the one white person there who decided not to go with a Marine evacuation. There wasn't a Marine evacuation the next morning there at the hotel, and I helped organize it. I took the passports and had to make some very tough decisions as to who went and who couldn't go on the helicopter, because there was room for only the people who were in the greatest danger. And, of course, I would have been one of the first to go on the helicopter, and I elected not to do it, even at that point, for two reasons. One reason was that my office was in the Mamioko, and all of my books and academic notes and field notes were there, and even though they had looted the hotel, I felt likely they would not have destroyed those things. So I had to get back in that hotel and to try to retrieve my materials. But I also stayed because I felt that although that I was in a pressure cooker environment there, everybody was afraid, everybody wanted to leave, I felt that if I got into the city, it would be more normal. And I was still, even then, determined to stay. And indeed, later that day, as the helicopters were flying off, taking my friends to the American aircraft carrier, I made my way back to my house in town. The hotel was still being looted. I knew it was very dangerous, and I waited 3-4 days. And then I sort of took my courage up and went to the main military headquarters and asked to see the head of military police to see if they could help me get into the hotel and see if my books were still there. I was almost shaking. It was very frightening. And I, but again, it shows you that you do become a part of a country if you stay there long enough. I went up to the desk and I was about to tell my tale when the soldier looked up at me and said, "Aren't you Joe Apala?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Aren't you the chap who's done all of this interesting research connecting us to our brothers in South Carolina, the Gula?" And I said, "Yes." And then he looked at me and he said, "If I call my fellow soldiers over here, would you mind taking a group picture with us?" And that's the way I entered the military headquarters. I took the group picture. They gave me a vehicle. They took me into the looted hotel. The rebels had shot their way through a plate glass window into my office, and my books were strewn all over the floor. But I found everything. They hadn't destroyed them, and the soldiers helped me pack my books up, and they even took me to my home. So there was still this bit of normality, and I was still determined to stay. But I would say a week passed, maybe 8 days passed, and I began to realize, even though I was living at home now, I began to realize that this was not like previous coups, that the soldiers who had taken over this time and looted the entire city, this was not like previous military governments. This was a government in name only. They had no control over their soldiers. They had brought the RUF rebels from the countryside into the town. Many of them were teenagers on drugs with AK-47s. The looting went on. It wasn't just in the first few days. It has, in fact, continued to the present moment. The officers are not able to control their enlisted men or the RUF, and there is looting and killing and raping going on every night. By that point, I was one of the last white people left in the city. And I knew that sooner or later they were going to come to me. And realizing that there was no protection, that there was no law and order, I finally realized I just had to go.
How did you go when you realized it was time to get out?
Actually, I got out by a fluke. I was still a bit indecisive, but we got to the point where, you know, they burned the National Bank, so all the banks shut down. They had no currency notes. They had attacked most of the shops in the town and looted the hotels and the restaurants, and so nothing was happening. People weren't going to work. They looted a lot of government offices. Things were coming to a standstill. And I was no longer able to get money. The Lebanese people who had cashed my American personal checks had all fled the country. and I didn't know how to get money so that I could survive and my household. I have an adopted son there, and I have people who work for me. I had to keep them going as well. So I went to, I inquired about the Lebanese ambassador. You know, the Lebanese are the business community there, and I was told that he had fled. But someone said that the Syrian ambassador or consul to Sierra Leone was still there, and he is an ethnic Lebanese. And I went to see him to ask him, do you know any Lebanese merchants who can still cash foreign checks? And I went into his office, and before I could open my mouth, he looked at me and he said, thank God you're here. He said, the last evacuation of the Lebanese people will take place tomorrow, and you just have to be on that. He didn't think it was safe for me to be there. And I opened my mouth to say, no, that's not why I came, but that didn't come out. I just said, yeah, you're right. And I went home and packed and then went out on a fishing boat with about 200 of the last Lebanese civilians.
Did you take your adopted son with you?
No, there was no way. In fact, we were taken to Guinea, the neighboring country, and the Guineans... the few Sierra Leoneans that were on board with Sierra Leone passports were given a very, very difficult time and pushed away. That was a hard decision, but I think he will be okay. I think, you know, I was much more of a target. He can blend in. And I must say this, if I had been an African American, I'd probably still be there. I was just too very obvious in that situation.
Joseph Opala is an American anthropologist who lived in Sierra Leone for 20 years. We'll talk more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Joe Opala, an American anthropologist who lived in Sierra Leone for 20 years. He recently fled the country to get away from the military coup and the soldiers who were looting, raping, and shooting in the streets. But he had to leave behind his adopted son. What are your concerns now for your son and for your friends who are still in Sierra Leone?
I think Sierra Leoneans who know what's going on all are praying and hoping for a Nigerian invasion. The Nigerians have continued to build up their forces at the national airport across the harbor from the city. They are working as a part of a multinational group called ECOWAS, the Economic Organization of West Africa. So there are also some troops from Ghana and neighboring Guinea. And ECOWAS has held negotiations with the thugs who've taken over the city. At this point, I understand they have given them an ultimatum. Either they step down or the Nigerian-led force will go in within a couple of weeks. We're praying for that. I have to say, honestly, the Western countries, the U.S. and Britain in particular, have not been very helpful in this. You know, Nigeria is a pariah nation, and I can understand that. So the Americans and British have not been very encouraging on the Nigerians going in, but it's the only thing that can save us.
Well, it's such a paradox, really, to be praying for an invasion by a country that runs a dictatorship.
Yeah, and but, you know, a friend of mine, Zainab Bangura, a close friend of mine who is the country's foremost human rights advocate, was in London last week speaking to an official in their foreign ministry. And he said the same thing. You know, you want this bloody dictatorship to go in and help you. And she said, when you're drowning and a shark takes you to shore, you say thank you. And then she said, of course, we'd prefer it not to be a shark. And if the British and Americans, the democracies, were to help us, that would be better. And I understand that the gentleman fell silent. It's unfortunate, but the Nigerians are the only ones who are in a position to save Sierra Leone.
Are you feeling very dislocated now?
Well, Sierra Leone is home for me, and yes, I do feel dislocated, and I've sought out Sierra Leoneans since I've been here in Washington. There are so many of them here, and we've shared our grief and our hopes. I have two countries, really, and I am very much an American. I love my country, but I also love Sierra Leone, and I'm not going to stop trying to do what I can for it.
When you decided that, okay, you'd get out on this Lebanese ship that was leaving, there were more people who wanted to get out that could have fit on the ship. And you were lucky enough to have been taken aboard. You were in the position earlier of having to judge who gets out and who doesn't. when you were helping decide who would get on the American planes. How did you make those decisions? What were your criteria?
Well, it wasn't just me, although there were times when I did have to make that decision. You have to remember that the American embassy was gone, and there was nobody from the embassy who could make those decisions. We had received some criteria from the Americans. But by that point, I think we wanted to get out people who were going to be in most danger, and that obviously was foreigners and European or Middle Eastern or Asian foreigners in particular. But we also, there were certain Sierra Leoneans that we did our best for who had simply suffered so very much that we had to help them and do whatever we could to get out. One moment that I will never forget, I was sitting there at the table accepting the passports, and a lady came up to me, a Sierra Leonean woman whom I have known for many years. She worked with the United States Information Service at the United States Embassy for her whole professional life. She had retired, and she's in her 60s now. And she came to me broken, stood there with two small grandchildren. The soldiers had gone into her home and looted everything she had, and then her poor neighbors came in and took the rest of it, right down to the cups and spoons. And she wept when she told me that the lady down the street who came in once a week to braid her granddaughter's hair, that she had seen her looting her kitchen. And she had an envelope, a manila envelope, and she said, "This is all I have left in the world." And she took out a plaque that she had received upon her retirement from the American Embassy, congratulating her on 25 years service. And she had one birth certificate from one of her grandchildren who had been born in England. She had no documentation on the other child. She didn't even have a passport for herself. And she begged me to put her on that helicopter, which of course I did. And the American Embassy in the neighboring country of Guinea did what they could for her. But there were so many people like that who came up and just looked me in the eye and said, "I have nothing left." Old people who had worked their whole lives, and they said, "This is just what I'm wearing."
I just have one more question for you. I know you want to go back to Sierra Leone. Do you think you could face another coup there?
Oh, absolutely. I have a tremendous faith in the country. This may sound strange, but knowing the country as I do, I don't feel the country has fallen apart. I feel the government has fallen apart. I think Sierra Leone is a viable country. There's not a lot of ethnic hatred or ethnic conflict there. Sierra Leoneans know who they are, and that country really could work. The problem is that its government has gradually eroded until it's completely collapsed. The problem now is trying to figure out how to build a viable government in Sierra Leone. But it's a country that can work. And I still believe in that country, and I still want to be a part of the process of helping put it together.
Joe Opala, I really wish you good luck, and glad you're safe.
Thank you.
Joe Opala is an American anthropologist who has lived in Sierra Leone for over 20 years. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. He plans to do research in the Georgia Sea Islands until he can return to Sierra Leone.